Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the role of the concertmaster in making symphony performances as perfect and powerful as they can be? When the DSO's concertmaster Emmanuel Borok announced last year that he would retire at the end of August following a 25-year tenure with the organization, a global search began for his replacement. And in an unusual arrangement for an American orchestra, the extremely demanding responsibilities will be shared at the DSO by two violinists. Concertmaster Alexander Carr of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, also a professor of music at Indiana University, and co-concertmaster Nathan Olson of the Canton Symphony Orchestra. They're here now to talk to us about their new positions and about what drew them to Dallas for this next phase of their careers. Alex, Nathan, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So the title of concertmaster sounds very glamorous, and of course you get to play all those enviable violin solos, but there is like a huge amount of work in addition to functioning as a member of the orchestra. Can you talk about what goes into the job?
Of course. Basically, a concertmaster does a lot more than what people just see. They see the person who stands up at the beginning of the concert and asks the oboe to give the A. But it goes a lot deeper than that. The concertmaster sets, first of all, the bowings, all the articulations that the string players play, and everybody else works from that set of articulations. Also, the concertmaster is a bit of a liaison between all the different groups of the orchestra, not only the string section within itself, but also between the string section, the wind section, the brass section, and sometimes even between the conductor and the orchestra and management in the orchestra.
Are there little cliques within an orchestra? Like, do the strings hate the brass, or does it work that way?
There certainly can be different groups of people that tend to, you know, spend time together. And, you know, part of our job as concertmasters is to try to get to know everybody and not be a part of those cliques ourselves, because that could be a problem and create rifts, you know, between people. We ideally want the whole orchestra to be functioning as a single unit. And if there are personal tensions, that can hamper that.
So. I'm curious, Jaap van Zweden said that one of the things that you'd be great at, Alex, is serving as a sort of father to the orchestra, which implies not only this really caretaking role, but maybe a little bit of discipline as well.
Well, I think the discipline of the orchestra is actually really quite good here in Dallas. I mean, I'm quite amazed that it's such, especially with Jaap there. I mean, the concentration is really unbelievable during rehearsals. I think what Jaap means is that I've had a lot of experience. I mean, I've played for a lot of years as a concertmaster and concertmaster of different orchestras. So I know what tensions can be there. I know how to sort of navigate the waters between, you know, dealing with people. And I think it's funny, when I came to this job, I actually started being a concertmaster very much at Nathan's age, when about 24. And yeah, you always have those little pitfalls that you think, oh, why did I do that? How could I have done that? And one of the things that I told myself when I was coming to this position was, you know, you get the chance to do it all over again. How would you do it? Hmm. And I promised myself that I was going to do it right from the first moment that I got here. And I think in a way that experience will help me sort of, well, get the trust of the orchestra, obviously, but also be able to lead them in a more efficient way and help people feel more comfortable.
What kinds of tensions do arise?
Well, you know, the same tensions that arise in any workplace, really. I mean, you know, people come to see the finished product. They come to see the concert. So sometimes it's hard to personalize these people that you see on stage. You see them playing music. You see them ideally at the top of their game. But really, we're no different than any other group of people that have to work together on a daily basis. So, you know, there are always going to be personalities that don't mesh well together. And, you know, like I said before, it's part of our job as concertmasters is to help smooth over those problems.
So, Nathan, you are 24, and it's not a secret. In fact, it's something that everybody's talking about because it's sort of exciting. I mean, what does it take when you, and this is not your first concertmaster gig or co-concertmaster here in Dallas, but what does it take to have the confidence to do it the first time?
Right. Well, it is my first full-time job in an orchestra. I've had several, I play in several part-time orchestras. I live in Cleveland right now in the area. Being concertmaster certainly does take a certain level of self-confidence, because there will be things that go wrong at times, and you have to quickly decide what you're going to change, what changes you're going to make or not make changes. And it just takes a certain level of you know, knowing what to do and being sure about it and not worrying about, you know, the whispers that are going to be going on behind you. You know, in a violin section, we have, I think, 8 stands or so of firsts in the Dallas Symphony. So that's 16 people who are all going to have their own opinions on how something needs to be changed. So you have to be very confident in yourself, and also at the same time, approach things in a friendly manner, a collegial manner. You don't want to come off as pompous or arrogant. So it's a delicate balance. I'm certainly looking forward to learning from Alex. So.
Well, it's an interesting thing because you have so many well-trained people. I mean, people who have been trained at the highest level of their job. And when you put that many people on stage, of course there are that many opinions. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, as Nathan said, the concertmaster is to galvanize those opinions. And, just in the way we speak, but also in our body movements, how we move is basically telling everybody, this is my interpretation of what the conductor's doing. This is where we'll play. And everybody can look at you, not just your own violin section. It's not really even about that. It's about anybody who chooses to look that wants to be on the same page. And that is the most important thing I think a concertmaster can do is bring the whole orchestra as a whole with the conductor's vision to help the conductor and facilitate the vision of the conductor going through directly into sort of the technical side of things, and then the audience can appreciate that.
So when you say how you move, what exactly does that mean? I mean, watching from the audience, I am not an expert, and so I see you moving, and it looks like you're simply playing the violin.
Basically, when you move, I mean, it's a natural motion. And what the ending, what they call leading with the body, is basically just a slight exaggeration of the movements that you would naturally make when you play the instrument, unless you're extremely tense. Mm-hmm. But when you're playing the instrument, there's that natural feeling of when you're about to enter. And what a concertmaster does is facilitates that by his body movements. He can literally sort of give everybody a sort of a heads up, a rhythmic heads up as to when the timing comes, boom, we come in here. And by leading that gesture, just as the conductor leads the gesture, basically what you want to do is mirror the motions of the conductor. And so at that point, the other principles mirror your motions, mm-hmm. and then everybody comes together synchronized. Because the fact is that the speed of light is faster than the speed of sound. Sometimes if you rely only on your ears, you're late, because the sound travels a little bit slower than light. So if you move together, there's a much greater likelihood of actually playing together, and the communication can be actually that much faster.
So how does the communication work between you and any conductor that you're working with, you as concertmaster?
Well, Alex certainly has much more experience with different conductors, so you could probably speak on this better than I could. But, it will be slightly different with each person you work with. I've worked with conductors who are relatively hands-off as far as giving the orchestra feedback. So in that case, the concertmaster would have to take charge more, maybe turn around, say more things to, the first violin section or the whole strings or even at times the winds or brass. The other conductors who really take care of most things themselves, which makes our job as concertmasters easier. So it can really vary depending on who's on the podium.
Definitely. if you think about somebody, the difference between someone like Jaap, who is incredibly hands-on, and hands-on for many reasons. First of all, he's had experience in the same job that we have done our entire careers. So, I mean, he was a wonderful concertmaster. He knows exactly how he wants to work with a string section, but also the experience that he's garnished over the past, 20 years that he's been conducting. I mean, one thing that happened this week, which I found fascinating, was he was talking to, actually Nathan and I both were remarking about it during the rehearsal. He was talking to one of the percussionists, and there's a part where the drum needs to be slapped on the outside, not on the actual the surface of the drum, but on the rim on the outside. And Jaap talked to the percussionist and said, "Excuse me, have you ever thought of turning the drum upside down and doing the same thing?" And I thought, how would he know that? The guy's a violinist, but he knows how he wants everything. And I like the fact that it does make our jobs that much easier. The experience that he has in all facets of the job, it's his details are so unbelievably. I mean, he sees everything, notices everything, and therefore it's much easier upon us.
So we have Jaap van Zweden, and we have now Marvin Hamlisch coming in for the pops, and we have various guest conductors, but it's the same orchestra. And I'm curious about how does it sound for someone who really knows music like the same orchestra every time, just working with different conductors, or is the job of the orchestra to be whatever that conductor wants, depending on what the piece is?
Well, I think ideally the orchestra has to be flexible. I think one thing when I played in Amsterdam in the Concertgebouw Orchestra, I think one of the things that I loved the most about that orchestra was its flexibility. The fact that if you were playing with, let's say, Jaap van Zweden, that the romanticism, that his is extreme, the nature of the extreme dynamics that he wants, the colors, was very apparent. But then you would work with someone like Nicholas Harnoncourt, who was what they call a sort of performance practice specialist, someone who was very well-versed in doing the early literature of Baroque and early classical period. And you could sound at that point like a Baroque orchestra. So I think that flexibility is something that any orchestra should actually cherish. And I think we've just started with the Dallas Symphony, so it's hard to know what the strengths are. But I have a feeling that the orchestra is going to be very flexible.
At the same time, different orchestras are known for different aspects of their sound. Just to give an example or two, Cleveland Orchestra is kind of known for their string sound. The ensemble is very tight, and they play very lush. They don't often overextend themselves dynamically. They don't play super loud, but it's always very together and very lyrical and smooth sounding. Just one example, Chicago, I think, is known often for their brass. Mm-hmm. Different aspects of the orchestra will tend to come out no matter who is, what music you're playing or who is there. But as Alex said, it is important to be very flexible.
What reputation does the Dallas Symphony Orchestra have in other parts of the country?
Oh, it's a very interesting question. I mean, I would say that the symphony is known for being very clean. It's known for having a great body of sound. I think it's also known, at this point right now, it's funny, it really depends a lot on who the music director is. Mm-hmm. Every orchestra with a certain music director takes on a certain personality. I think with Jaap, it's very clear that the orchestra has it's very precise. It has a huge body of sound. It's very clean. I think that's a very good thing to be, actually.
So I want to talk about the audition process, at least for the performance side of this job. I was unaware that this, initially at least, the early rounds take place and the people who are listening and making the decisions have no idea who's playing.
Right. That's kind of a recent development that's come into the classical music world. For years, you'd go up and play an audition and the whole committee could see you. Recently they've been trying, orchestras have been trying to make this process more impartial so that the people judging the person playing do not actually know who that person is. So that for the first few rounds of an audition, there'll be a big cardboard wall basically in between you and the people you're playing for, which can be a little off-putting the first couple times you audition because there's a normal kind of give and take with the audience when you're performing. You kind of feed off their energy.
Based on what you see in their faces?
It's difficult to explain. It's more kind of, it could be that, but generally I personally don't really look at people's faces in the audience while I'm playing. It's more just the feeling that they're there and that you're inspiring emotions in them while you're playing. And when you can't see them, when there's no actual proof that they're there, it becomes more difficult to inspire yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It almost feels more clinical.
Right.
When you're in front of a screen, it feels like you're trying to sort of perform correctly instead of sort of inspire.
In a different way than even a practice would if you were just by yourself in a closed room somewhere.
God, I practice a lot of intensity, actually. I don't know how you practice, Nathan, but I kind of never relax.
Well, yeah, it's hard to say. But the good part about the auditions is that usually for the final round, when they've narrowed it down to a few candidates, they will remove the screen.
Then you can wow them.
Right, exactly. Well, ideally, yes.
We're going to take a little break here. Will you guys play something for us after the break?
Of course.
That'd be great.
Sounds great. My guests this hour are Alexander Carr, Dallas Symphony Orchestra Concertmaster, and Nathan Olson, the co-concertmaster. If you'd like to join the conversation after we hear our little performance, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Nathan Olson, co-concertmaster of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, and Alexander Carr, concertmaster of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. They're here now to play for us Prokofiev's Sonata for Two Violins. Was great. My guests this hour are Alexander Carr and Nathan Olson, concertmaster and co-concertmaster of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. Guys, thank you so much for that. That was probably the coolest thing that's happened in here all year.
Thank you.
Great. I'm curious about, you know, watching you from here. It seems like, and I noted it especially with you, Alex, that you're breathing at specific times. Is that something that you're conscious of?
Not at all.
Really?
I try to keep breathing because, I mean, no, I hate to quote the Karate Kid, but no breathe, no life. But it does keep you much more relaxed if you're breathing naturally and openly. Mm-hmm. The more you suck in your breath, the more tension you build.
Yeah.
And we do kind of try to mimic wind players in that aspect because wind players naturally obviously have to breathe in before they play. And as string players, obviously we don't have to do that in order to physically play the instrument, but it helps a lot. You know, even if you're just playing by yourself, but also especially as a group, if you breathe together before you come in, much more likely you'll play at the same time.
So when selection has been decided for the orchestra and you know what your part is and you know what everyone's part is, talk about the sort of interplay between practicing on your own, and I don't know if you go to a studio or if you do it at home, and then coming together. And is it small groups first or does everyone come together all at once? How does that work?
In youth orchestras, they'll often have what we call string sectionals or sectionals for all groups of the orchestra before the whole orchestra comes together. You know, the first violins will meet together and the second violins, or maybe the strings without the winds and brass, and gradually piece things together. In professional orchestras, it is obviously imperative that everybody knows their own part quite well before coming to rehearsal. So ideally, everybody will have looked at their part quite extensively, know the music backwards and forwards. So that by the time we get to the first rehearsal, everybody is actually quite on top of things in their own, as far as their own part goes. you know, then it's just a matter of getting comfortable with each other, because often something can be easy by yourself but quite difficult when matching it with other people. So.
And then how does it change when the conductor sort of puts his or her stamp on the piece? And what might be different from the way you would all just sit down having practiced independently and the finished piece?
Oh, there are countless things that would be different. I think one of the most important things is timing, obviously, mm-hmm. is that the conductor really controls the timing. When you're playing by yourself, actually, a lot of things become easier because you're basically trying on playing correctly in a certain rhythmic pattern. But when you play with a conductor who's beating you and has a different set of timing, it changes every variable in the way you actually technically approach the instrument. Now add to that the fact that you're doubling a flute, and you're doubling the flute at light speed. So all of you are trying to play together at the exact same time, looking at a conductor, listening to each other, and trying to technically approach your instrument in a correct way. So all of these factors at the same time make it incredibly difficult, which is why you definitely need to rehearse. It's like trying to, you know, a chamber music group, ideally an orchestra is like a very large chamber music group, where we're all not only relying on the conductor, which is, of course, a huge factor, but that we're listening to each other and reacting to each other. And that takes time to sort of, for everything to sort of gel together.
It must be really cool to be in the middle of a huge group of people all making this extraordinary music. I mean, is that still thrilling, or you guys are so used to it by now that it doesn't strike
No, I mean,
you?
That's why we do what we do. It's for those great moments when everything is going well and everything comes together, to be part of, you know, such a big group of people who are all focused on one thing and, you know, ideally moving as one unit and making music as one unit is really, that is the thrill of what we do. So
you see 110 people on stage, especially with something like we're playing this week, the Sixth Symphony of Mahler, which is going to be a fantastic concert, by the way, so people should really try to get there. But a piece like that involves it's an hour and a half long, mm-hmm. and it doesn't stop. It never lets up emotionally for 1 second. The concentration also never lets up. So, you know, when you have a piece that like that, imagine, the group of fish that when one of the fish turns, the entire group turns.
And it looks like they turn at the same time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Basically, that's what an orchestra has to be, 110 people who can turn on a dime. Especially when you have a conductor that demands such flexibility and tempo, that it takes an incredible amount of concentration. And to keep that up for an hour and a half, imagine just trying, in everyday life to keep your concentration up in anything you do, any task that you do for an hour and a half. It's incredibly difficult, incredibly taxing, and it's something that you really need to practice on stage before the concert, because to get that kind of muscle memory but also that kind of focus, relaxed focus, it's very difficult to achieve.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I was in the Dallas Youth Orchestra when I was in high school, and I was in the third stand, and I was a cellist, and I noticed at that time there was no American Idol, but there's sort of an American Idol quality to being in that position. And I was hoping you guys could just comment a little bit more on sort of professional jealousy, because you got to know, and this is the way it was in the orchestra when I was in the youth orchestra, everybody behind you thinks that they can do your job. And in fact, they really can't. You guys are extraordinary to get these jobs. So talk a little bit about that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's funny. It's a thing that you have to deal with very early on in your career. It's the feeling that you know the people behind you are excellent musicians. That's a fact. And you do have to have that internal stomach, that strength to know. But, you know, even to perform, you need that strength. To go in front of 2,500 people every night and say, listen to me, I'm worth it. That takes a certain amount of confidence. And I think to galvanize an entire group of people, yeah, it does take some stomach. And you have to develop that soon, and you have to develop it early in your career, or it can make you a little crazy.
This is you're going to laugh at the question, but are the very formal looking suits that you wear, are they specially designed to allow you to move any better than any other men's suit would be?
No, and it does take a certain amount of getting used to, because when we practice at home, we're in t-shirts or pajamas, maybe. They're big shoulder pads in these suits, and, it does feel different, especially with a bow tie or a long tie. So you get used to it over the years, but it is a little bit different. But, no, they're not specially designed, unfortunately.
And it makes me crazy. I have to tell you, to switch in 1 week between a bow tie, like let's say I have a chamber music concert as well as orchestral appearances, to go from a long tie to a bow tie to no tie is just infuriating.
Because it's different every time.
With women are much luckier in this respect because they usually wear things that are, you know, they don't have jackets or they can wear just regular dresses and wear that consistently. But whereas with men, we always have to change our weather jacket or no jacket or this or that. It's kind of frustrating.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ron in Cedar Hill. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I've always been wondering, why is a concertmaster always a violinist?
I know some people that would want to answer that.
Not violinists, I'm guessing.
No. You want to take this one?
that's a very good question, and it's an interesting one to think about. You know, the way that the concertmaster role arose was before conductors were really an established position. Conductor is a strange thing when you think about it. They're not making a sound. Before they were around, the first chair violinist would just lead. I think that's probably because the first violin is playing the upper line, which is most often the melody, so it can probably be heard most easily by all members of the group. Therefore, it'd be easier to follow them. That would make sense to me.
And the early concertmasters were armed. So that's another, probably a reason why they were leaders.
Is that a joke?
Actually, no, it's true.
They were armed.
They would come.
They came in with swords. And
they came in with swords.
Really?
Yeah, it's kind of funny.
Just as a ceremonial, as a fashion statement.
I hope. No, it's funny. I think that Nathan's absolutely right. I think that the concertmaster position was there before conductors, and then eventually Lully, who was the first conductor, who eventually stabbed himself in the foot with his the stick that he pounded on the floor to keep time, and eventually died from the gangrene that came from that. Concertmasters basically, we led the orchestra, and I think it's because we were melodic lines, and also we're playing the most often. And also people can see us the easiest. We're at a place in the orchestra where people can see us. So I think that it was sort of a natural progression into that field.
Do you guys have to avoid cooking and yard work and things that could get you injured?
You know, there have been some famous musicians who have had those kind of problems. Was it not just Leonard Sonnenberg who cut off
the top of her finger?
Top of her finger, and there have been others that are slipping my mind right now. But you certainly do have to be careful.
Yeah, it does. You have to be. I used to love skiing, and I still do, but I'm very careful about doing that these days.
You'd be 6 months out if you.
Yeah, it's a kind of thing where if you want your career to last a long time, you have to be wary about certain things you do. Even for me now, I'm 40 and I'm still young, but playing tennis, kind of scary to throw out your shoulder. Certain exercises aren't too much fun for you.
Do you have your hands insured, Alex?
No, I haven't gotten that egomaniac yet.
You're your violin insured though, right?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm.
How do you decide which is the violin that you're going to use?
That's good.
Why don't you speak on that, Alex?
It's funny. It's a violin. It's a very personal relationship. I mean, it's something that when you choose a violin, it's you're choosing your mate. It's like getting married. I think everybody has their own personal thought of how to produce sound and the type of sound that they want to produce. And when you play a violin, you want to hear the natural voice that it produces when you play in the most natural way possible for you. And I think that's a way how people, can look at an instrument. I think certain instruments that are older, Italian instruments, but also, I play on a French violin. Certain violins that are older have an easier, I think they're the wood has shifted enough over time that the varnish has set in over time enough that it resonates a little bit more naturally. Therefore, that's why the older instruments are a little bit easier to play in certain ways. But I think whether you're a Del Gesu player or a Strad player, it all depends on your personality, how you feel, how you operate with the instrument, and the voice that you're trying to create.
And one way that I've heard this described to me that made a lot of sense to me was, imagine, say, Pavarotti. If he had had somebody else's voice box and vocal cords, would he have been the same musician? Probably not. So our violins are our vocal cords and our voice boxes. So,
and how does it work? And I'll ask you as well, Alex, but Nathan, since you're 24, did your parents buy your first really good violin? Was it something you got a loan for? How does that work?
Right. Violins and all string instruments are prohibitively expensive. It's really almost hard to believe the prices that are out there. So some of the top line Strads and Del Gesus are in the several millions of dollars. And so most musicians cannot afford that. You know, top-notch violinists will often be borrowing instruments from foundations or very wealthy people who buy these instruments as investments and loan them out. The violin I play on now, my parents did buy. It's not, you know, a top-of-the-line instrument, but it's a very good instrument that I've grown quite fond of. But yeah, people do have to take out quite large loans, and it is quite a heavy load to bear.
I played on a modern instrument that my parents bought for me when I was, I think, 12 years old. Actually, 14 years old. And I played that instrument until I got my job in Amsterdam with the Concertgebouw Orchestra. And it's funny. I mean, I still use a $2,500 bow made by the man who lived across the street from me in Alexandria, Virginia.
By the way, $2,500 is cheap.
For a bow, yeah.
I'm assuming that, although... Yeah, from where I sit in public radio, it sounds like a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, but compared to $100,000 or $150,000,
just for the bow. What would be so different about a bow at that price?
The balance of how the weight is equally balanced over the length of the stick, how easily it jumps, the type of sound that it produces. You know, it's funny, they're starting to make now, because Pernambuco has basically become outlawed to be used to make bows, and because it's become a rare wood. They've been making a lot of carbon fiber bows. And the one thing with certain ones, they're getting really good now. But one thing you could always notice is just the bounce point is always a little bit awkward. The sound that you produce is just—it's not quite the same. There's something missing. It's almost as if the sound lacks a certain humanity, a certain depth in it. But it can make a huge difference. I mean, I think that, yeah. I mean, it's just the one I've used since I was a kid, and I've always been so comfortable with it. I just never thought about buying another bow.
You've got a few seconds to finish your thought.
No, but it's a very interesting thing. It's again, bows and violins are very personal, but yeah, violins can go up to $10-15 million these days. So it is prohibitive.
My guests this hour are Alexander Carr and Nathan Olson, concertmaster and co-concertmaster of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Chris Boyd, you're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guests this hour are Nathan Olson, co-concertmaster, and Alexander Carr, concertmaster of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. Let's go next to Steve in Dallas. Hi, Steve.
Oh, hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Well, I have two quick questions. One, who chooses the program selections when there's a guest conductor? And the second question is, why does the orchestra tune to the oboe? And I'll hang up and listen online.
Thanks for your call.
It's actually two very good questions. I think when it comes to guest conductors, the artistic director of the orchestra and the guest conductor themselves sort of agree upon a program. I think eventually in conjunction with the music director. I think the music director has certain repertoire that he would like to do, and therefore it's kind of off limits from guest conductors. But then at that point, the guest conductor gets together with the artistic director and then decides upon a program that they can mutually agree upon.
And the oboe?
The oboe is just a very clean, clear sound, and it you know, really projects the overtones of the A that they're playing very well. So it's easy for us to hear it and tune to it simply.
What are you listening for when you're tuning the orchestra? There's nobody really who's far off, is there?
Well, you'd be surprised. I mean, you know, these instruments, as we carry them around, you know, they can get bumped or jostled, and the strings on a violin can quite easily slip or just move slightly, and even a slight loosening or tightening of the string can affect the pitch level quite drastically. So we really just want to line up as closely as we can. You know, otherwise it won't sound very good. So.
I was at a performance a couple of months ago, not of the DSO, and a violin player broke a string during a performance. He couldn't stop. What do you do?
Sometimes you have to stop, depending on what you're playing. And I've broken a couple of strings. I remember there was that one day, remember when Midori broke like three strings? Like she broke one string, took the concertmaster's violin, broke another string, took the second person's violin, and just kept going down the line. But I think at some point you run out of violins.
Often, and I guess I should get on this, but the second chair player in the orchestra will often have a set of strings actually with them on stage just in case something like that happens. And but I haven't been doing that, so I should.
It takes a while, right, to get that all, I don't know, what you applied on the violin. Like, to change them out takes a few minutes, right?
Right. I mean, it's, you know, kind of like watching NASCAR. I mean, in NASCAR, they,
like a pit stop.
Right. They can do it in, you know, 12.2 seconds, whereas, you know, you take your car to the shop and it takes, you know, 4 hours. In a pinch, we could probably change a string in, you know, 20 seconds if everything went well, if everything went smoothly.
Wow.
It would take practice to do it at that speed, though. So.
Yeah.
We have an email here from Paul who wants to know, would the ideal first violin section have every musician in the section sound exactly the same?
Ooh, wow.
Well, just to start off, I mean, that can be approached from a number of different angles, but one thing that's different in various orchestras is kind of the balance between different parts of the section. For example, in Cleveland, where I live now, and I've occasionally subbed at the back of the section, the front of the section plays quite loudly, and the back of the section kind of blends into the front of the section sound. So kind of the sound gets less and less as you move to the back of the sections, whereas Yop here in Dallas, and I think everywhere he goes, likes for the back to play not necessarily more than the front, but at least as much. So that's one difference. But
yeah, I think that I think it's impossible for every violinist to sound exactly the same. I mean, we have different violins, we have different physiques, but I think we do try to match timbre as much as possible. I think when you play chamber music or when you play in an orchestra, what's imperative is to find people when you're actually in the audition process that have a blendable sound. By blendable, I mean nothing that's too strident, nothing that's too light, things that can actually mesh with another instrument, and not only a violin, but can mesh with the viola, mesh with a cellist. So when you're playing, like especially when you're playing quartets, to have a blendable sound is paramount, because if one person has, like, let's say you have Yasha Heifetz coupled with the second violinist would be Artur Grumio, with Lynn Harrell playing cello, and then a different violist, William Primrose, the sound, unless they tried to match timbres, which of course they would because they're all great musicians, unless they tried to match timbres, they wouldn't naturally mesh because the sound qualities are so completely different.
Well, you talked about physiques, and I'm wondering, you're like 6 feet tall, Alex. If you were playing next to a woman who was 5 feet tall, could you sort of tell with your eyes closed that they were two people who were sort of sized and shaped differently?
No. I mean, I would have to say that it depends on how you use physics to your advantage. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a difference at all. I've one of the largest sounds I've ever heard out of a violinist was from a woman, and a very small one. So I don't think that's the case.
We've talked several times on the show about the genius myth that people are just born magically gifted. And I'm sure that both of you have dealt with this over the years. And I wonder if I can have your take on the idea that geniuses are simply born and that the rest of us, that there's not so much work to it as just this amazing gift.
Well, you know, there's something to be said for talent. You know, there are some people that, you know, no matter how much work they put into something, just can't get as good at it as somebody else who puts in the same amount of work. That being said, certainly nobody in a professional orchestra anywhere has not put in hours and hours and hours and hours of practice. So I think it's probably less important than the amount of work you put in, but I wouldn't dismiss it completely.
I think that there's a great book that I read recently called Talent is Overrated, and I think it's fascinating the fact that somebody said that in order to be sort of fluent at anything, it would require something like 10,000 hours of work. And I agree to a certain extent, and to a great extent actually, in that. I think, you know, people who succeed are those who are, and in my opinion, people like Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, in his prime, people like that are willing to do what no one else is willing to do. And it's that simple. If you love something that much, and I think you have in talent, I think talent for me is love. It's my love for something. And if you love something that much, and if you care about it that much, then you put that much time into it. And anyone who can put that much time into something focused and in a concentrated manner will succeed at it, I think. I think it's a question of being vulnerable to yourself, about allowing yourself to fail and yet pick yourself up and succeed. And but those hours are really important. Just the sheer work, the amount of times that you go over something over and over and over. And my mother would always say, you know, practice till your fingers bleed. But
did they have to make you practice?
Oh, yeah. My mother paid me to practice when I was a kid.
At what point did you go, oh, my gosh, I love this?
When I started basically traveling and, uh-huh. and started realizing where music could take me. Hmm. And just think, wow, I get to do this. I get to do something I love for a living.
What about you, Nathan?
You know, similar situation for me. I mean, there were certainly times when I was a kid and, you know, didn't really feel like practicing for that hour. But, you know, my parents certainly never forced me to play. I mean, it was up to – but if I was going to take lessons and if I was going to do it, I did need to practice for, you know, a certain amount every day. And, you know, some days it was great. Other days it was torture. But, yeah, I would say I really started to love it when I decided, you know, that I would try to make a career of it. And I went to the Cleveland Institute of Music, which is one of several conservatories in the States, at age 15. And I guess that's probably when I really started to know I wanted to do this.
And you both play multiple instruments. Was it always evident that the violin would be the principal one for you?
I actually started on piano about a year before I started violin. So at the beginning, no, it wasn't obvious. I played them both equally for a number of years. Probably around age 12 is when I started really concentrating on violin.
I think I took the violin as a means of rebellion. My mom is a piano teacher, and she was teaching me starting at like probably age 4 or 5. And I really loved playing piano, but I hated being taught by my mother. She's an amazing teacher. Don't get me wrong. She's an incredible musician and a wonderful teacher.
That's like parents can't teach their kids to drive or swim or any of that stuff.
Exactly. It should never happen. Mm-hmm. and so I rebelled and looked for another instrument. And I remember thinking I wanted to play the cello at first. When I went to find a cello in the public school system, I was too small for the cello that they had. So I ended up playing violin. And then I heard a recording of my teacher and also one of Michael Rabin. And I thought, yeah, I can do this. Hmm. I really loved it.
So do you have kids?
Yeah, I have 2 boys.
Do you teach them music or do they take lessons elsewhere?
No. They've been complaining to start something. Mm-hmm. And I've been hesitant to start them on anything. But now I think I'm going to have to give in. And one of my youngest son has said he wants to play the violin. My oldest said he wanted to play trombone. And when I said he was too young to start trombone, he said accordion. And I became apoplectic. no offense, accordion players.
Exactly. There's good money in, like, you know,
there is,
family polkas and bar mitzvahs.
And my wife's family is all Polish.
Perfect. So. let's go to the phones now. We'll go to Mike in Dallas. Hey, Mike. Hello, Mike. Are you with us?
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Great. Love the show. My question is, because I'm a working musician and a member of the union, and I wondered what everybody thought about the problems with financing classical orchestras and keeping this music alive that inspires everybody, and whether that impact has made its way into the Dallas Symphony and concerns about funding and making beautiful music for the public. So just wanted to know what you guys thought.
Thanks for your call. Huge issue these days.
It is an incredibly huge issue. One thing I can reassure everyone in the Dallas area is that the administration of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra is one of the most progressive, one of the most forward-thinking organizations that I've ever come across. I've been in contact quite a bit with the management there, primarily Paul Stewart, who is right now the CEO and soon to be the COO of the orchestra. And I can tell you I've rarely met anyone who is as forward-thinking in this business. I think this orchestra is going to be very, very safe for a long time to come, and it's going to be just getting better and better and better. I think this is the problem in this country right now is that the culture will suffer. It's very difficult to, especially in this economic climate, to find big sponsors. And frankly, the arts relies on sponsorship. Ticket sales can only account for so much of an orchestra's budget. And the orchestra needs that kind of support from its community or they simply cannot exist.
No, I think both Alex and I feel very fortunate to be walking into this situation. As Mike mentioned, you know, so many orchestras are having to scale back, or you know, are not playing at all, or at least scaling back substantially. Whereas here, it seems that the organization is somewhat immune to those concerns and is, in fact, trying to raise money and raise their profile nationally and internationally. So I think we're both very fortunate to be here.
So as concertmaster and co-concertmaster, Nathan, you're working at the times when Alex is not with the orchestra. Is that basically correct?
That's correct. I will, in fact, be playing the weeks that Alex is here. Mm-hmm. I'll be sitting on the first end with Alex. I think Alex will be playing 12 weeks next season and 16 the year after that. So yes, when Alex is not here, I will move over to the concertmaster chair and play, not for every single week that he's not there, but for a fair number of them. Yeah.
So how important is it that you all operate in a similar manner?
Well, I can tell you that we've been playing this week and it's been so much fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like playing with some, I mean, I thought it was important that we would get to know each other, but it's been so easy. I mean, we've gone out to dinner a few times just to talk and share ideas, but it's been such a natural progression. The last few days, it's so easy to play with him. I mean, you know, I've been blessed in my career with really good stand partners, but I couldn't ask for anyone better.
Well, that's very kind, Alex. but to answer your question, I think it is certainly important that we are at least similar in style, because you don't want to have to make the orchestra jump back and forth between, you know, two totally different ways of leading. I mean, certainly we won't be 100% the same. There's no way that could happen. But, you know, there's a wide range of ways in which concertmasters can lead. You know, there are schools of thought in which the concertmaster really moves a lot and is really leading everything, and there are other, even major orchestras that I've seen where the concertmaster almost barely moves. So there's a wide range in there, and I think we're similar enough, and I'll certainly adapt to Alex's style, so that there's not too much variance in what the orchestra has to look at in that chair every week.
Why is the concertmaster, co-concertmaster set up so uncommon here and so common in Europe?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it's much more of a human arrangement, to be honest. When you have more than one concertmaster, it's a lot of pressure. Yeah. To be honest, it's a lot of pressure in that role, and in I think to function at your best, it's great when you can actually leave the orchestra for a while, do your own projects, whether it's teaching, whether it's performing chamber music, or as a soloist, to keep really what we call our chops, our technical abilities up, but also to keep your sanity a bit. It really is nice to be able to share that responsibility with someone else. In Berlin, there were four concertmasters. In Vienna, three. And when I was in Amsterdam, we had two. I just think it's a better way of keeping it fresh all the time. And when you have two people who are young, I mean, relatively young for me and young, I think it's important to have that kind of freshness and vitality.
Well, we wish you guys all the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My guests this hour have been Alexander Carr, concertmaster, and Nathan Olson, co-concertmaster of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.